And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is lasting influence. Each of my guests is explaining the lasting impression their topic has on the world. My first guest realizes more products are similar than they are dissimilar. It's the people and the processes that differentiate one retailer from another. He described the science of creating lifetime customers contained in his book, Reinventing the Wheel. My second guest is a Yale psychologist who understands the sources of influence. He taught us how to achieve instant influence in 6 simple steps from his book titled Instant Influence. My next guest takes the dry subject matter contained in the periodic table of elements and makes it fun. He's that rare hybrid who bridges the best of science and the arts in his book titled Periodic Tables. And as always, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Hugh Addersley Williams was born in London in 1959. It's significant because that's the same year that C.P. Snow gave his famous speech about two cultures in the British society, the divide between the arts and the sciences. Perhaps that's where it all began for Hugh. Forced to choose arts or sciences in school and university, Hughes chose the latter and then gained his master's in natural science from Cambridge University. By graduation, though, Hugh was aware of his latent interest in the arts, particularly architecture and design, and he was seeking ways to satisfy all of the urges in something that resembled a career. Journalism is where he started, although after a few disastrous starts in journalism, he decided to become a freelance in 1986, where he was at last able to write about what really interested him in the newspapers and the magazines that he wrote for. Hugh has an American mother and an English father, which left him with something of a curious matter of nationality identity. Hugh is a member of the Society of Authors and a fellow at the Royal Society of Arts. He lives in Norfolk in Great Britain and London, where he lives with his wife, his son, and 2 Maine Coon cats. Welcome to the show, Hugh. How are you today?
I'm good.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest. I love to have thought leaders such as yourself. And the periodic table. I mean, most of us have a permanent place in our memory of the periodic table. Mostly it's bad because we're forced to memorize it in school. But aside from some of the common elements that you find on the periodic table, things like iron, carbon, copper, gold, which is in the news right now, the elements themselves pretty much are a mystery, at least they are to me as a non-science person. So these elements, they exist all around us, and though most of us are not aware of them that are out there. So you've chosen to write about the elements from a cultural history standpoint. What motivated you to examine the elements in such an accessible way?
Well, I think I really wanted to rescue the elements from the laboratory. I gained a sense as I was doing the book that chemists keep these beautiful treasures sort of hidden away to themselves, and they fiddle with them and make nice little explosions and colors and crystals and things like that, and don't tell us about it much unless we get the bug for chemistry as they teach it. And really, the elements are all around us, and they're in all the beautiful things in our lives and all the delicious meals we have and all the best paintings and the bad ones, too. And I just wanted to remind us of that, and they're in our language and literature and so on as well.
Well, they are, and you helped to bring them to light. One of the things, as more of a business person, that I found interesting with the price of gold and silver reaching new highs each day, it was hard for me to believe until I read your book that aluminum, or as you would say, aluminium, was once more valuable than gold. Tell us the history of aluminum, tell us the history of aluminum, please, Hugh.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not going to be able to say it, aluminum, but aluminium is one of the most abundant elements on the planet, but it took a long time before it was discovered because it is bonded so strongly to its in its oxide form in minerals in the earth that it took an awful lot of effort to separate it. So people like Lavoisier in France, in pre-revolutionary France, thought that there was this element tied up in these minerals but couldn't do it. And then rather later in the 19th century, they found a way to separate aluminium from its oxide, and they had to use sodium to do that. And sodium, if you remember from school, is an incredibly reactive element, and if you chuck a tiny little pea-sized lump of it into water, it explodes like crazy. And so by using sodium, you can get aluminium. sort of diminishing returns, really, because sodium is in many ways a lot more exciting than aluminium. But so that's what made aluminium terribly expensive to start with. It's a hugely expensive process to obtain it, because you had to first obtain your sodium. That involved an awful lot of effort in itself. Later, we have used a lot of hydroelectric power to create our aluminium, and that made it a lot cheaper. But just briefly, in the middle of the 19th century, it was regarded by many as more precious than gold. And there's this story of Napoleon III, who gave these banquets. And for his most honored guests, he would give them aluminium cutlery. And then the rest of the hoi polloi had to make do with just the ordinary workaday gold.
What a shame. My guest is Hugh Aldersey Williams, author of the book Periodic Tables, A Cultural History of the Elements from Arsenic to Zinc. And staying on the subject of gold, Hugh, for just a moment, you say in your book that there's enough gold in the sea to wreck the element's reputation as the currency standard. How so?
Well, there's an awful lot of sea is the answer. It's very, very dilute, and from time to time they've estimated how much there is in there, and from time to time these calculations have come out possibly slightly wrong, but rather encouraging, and so people have gone off and trawled the seas and tried to extract it. I mean, the difficulty is that it's there in such incredibly small amounts, sort of combined up with biological material, that you have to essentially sieve an awful lot of stuff, and then you would have to separate it from the sort of sludge that you got as a result, and it's just not worthwhile. The gold price of gold has to be an awful lot higher before anyone thought that was a worthwhile way of doing it, I think.
Sounds almost more like alchemy than it does science, Hugh, but let's stick with the precious metals if we can for a minute. Mm-hmm. Platinum is another precious metal out there, and Howard Hughes once offered a prize to the hairdresser related to this element. What was it, and what was the element, and what was the prize that he offered?
Well, this is one of these interesting cases where the element has a life for all of us, not just chemists, and that's sort of separate from its real existence as a material. So platinum for most of us means platinum credit cards, or when a record or a CD goes platinum, and of course platinum blonde. And Howard Hughes was responsible for making the film Platinum Blonde in the 1930s, which is a black and white movie. So as a sort of spin-off from that, there was this prize offered for the person who could, the hairdresser, who could best recreate the color of platinum blonde in their salon. And it was a bit of a trick, of course, because since the film was black and white, no one really knew, except if they'd been on the set, what the color truly was.
Well, it's an amusing story, just one of the many amusing stories in the book, Periodic Tales. Hugh, I was also amused by another story about phosphorus. First of all, tell us, what is phosphorus? And then tell us how phosphorus can be made from urine.
Okay. Phosphorus is it's a non-metal. I mean, most of the elements of the periodic table are metals, and you sort of recognize them by appearance. Phosphorus is a non-metal, and it comes in various forms. It can be white or red, and it's very inflammable. It's used or was used as an ingredient in matches and so on. If you just have a lump of phosphorus sitting out there in the air, it will sort of slowly burst into flames and produce a very bright bright light and an awful lot of white smoke. Very exciting element to have made. It was the first element that was sort of almost knowingly separated from its natural ingredients. Lots of the elements, not a lot, but enough lead and copper and gold and silver and so on had been known by in the ancient world, but phosphorus was the first one that was found sort of by what you might call modern science in 1669. And it was found by this guy Hennig Brandt, who was basically an alchemist, and he was looking for the philosopher's stone and trying to make gold, of course. But he did this very elaborate experiment, and he ended up, much to his surprise, creating phosphorus, this stuff that would sort of glow in your as you carried it around, and occasionally, if you weren't careful, would it burst into flames. And the way he did it was, it was a process of great tedium and unpleasantness, but he collected buckets and buckets and buckets of his own urine, and then allowed it to evaporate or distilled it down and got a solid residue. And then he reduced that solid residue with some charcoal and so on, with great heat in a carefully sort of sealed apparatus, and got this fantastic new element. And the reason why he thought, why look at urine? You might think, what's his clue to think anything's there? What the alchemists did was they basically did experiments on anything they could find that was yellow, because they thought that was close to gold. So they'd work with saffron or egg yolks or daffodils or whatever, you know, anything yellow would be a good starting point for them on their search to gold.
My guest is Hugh Aldersley Williams, author of the book Periodic Tales. He's telling us some amusing stories behind the elements in the periodic table. Now, some of the elements have double-edged, really. I mean, tell us the story behind chlorine. How did chlorine go from killing thousands to curing a U.S. president's cold?
Chlorine, I mean, yes, it's a very strong chemical. It attacks lots of things. You have to be pretty careful with it. And it was used, it was the first poison gas used in warfare in 1915 in the First World War. And the Germans employed it in trenches in Belgium. And the way they did it was, I mean, the reason it was useful to them was it didn't need to be incorporated into fancy shells or rockets or anything. All they did was plant a load of chlorine cylinders along their lines and waited for the wind to blow in the right direction and then released the chlorine gas, which is heavier than air. So this horrible sort of green choking carpet of gas rolled along the ground and caught a lot of the Allied troops unaware. And very shortly after that, you know, the whole gas warfare thing escalated and people retaliated with worse and worse gases on both sides. And actually they became less and less effective as better preparation was made for them, people wearing gas masks and so on. So actually that first attack was really the worst one there ever was. But ironically, it's thought that chlorine saved more lives than it killed, even during the First World War, because it was used to disinfect the water drunk by the troops. And after the First World War, it was used as a treatment against the flu, that was a very bad flu outbreak after the First World War.
The great influenza of 1918.
That's right,
yes.
Yeah. And although it wasn't actually terribly effective against that, that restored chlorine's reputation in people's minds that it was a not all a bad thing. Many of the elements have this sort of Janus-faced aspect to them. They have a kind of an evil usage very often, but they also have benign and you know, delightful uses. Another of my favorites is arsenic, which is of course a notorious poison, but it also provides this fantastic green color that the Victorians loved and used in wallpaper and paper flowers and paints like crazy, and you know, with a few people suffering consequences from that, but many more I expect just enjoying the color.
My guest is Hugh Aldersley Williams. We're talking about Periodic Tales, his book about the periodic elements. And you're broadcasting into California, Hugh. So one of the stories that I found amusing is our own U.S. military was considering using one of the elements. The element was vanadium.
Vanadium, yeah.
Tell us, what is the story behind U.S. military wanting to extract vanadium from California sea sponges?
Yeah, well, this is a hard one to get to the bottom of, and I'm not sure I'm really many people know much about it. It appears that vanadium, which is sort of one of the more obscure elements in some ways, it's used in steels a lot, and but you don't kind of see lumps of it around pure, as it were, but if you pick up a wrench, you'll find it stamped with the words vanadium steel. It's a very strong steel alloy. So that is an element that occurs when it's combined with other elements in lots of colors. It changes colors like salts of copper and cobalt and one or two other elements do. And it also was found to concentrate in these creatures called tunicates, the kind of sea sponge that stick themselves to the seabed, and they're very colourful. They occur in sort of multicoloured arrays, and presumably it's something to do with the vanadium that concentrates in them. But no one really knows why they concentrate that element. You know, it might be something to do with their immune system. It doesn't seem to be in their blood. You know, octopuses have copper in their blood, like we have iron in our blood. So, you know, it was obviously thought that vanadium might be in these creatures' blood, but it's not. And so this news came to the attention of the U.S. Army, and they wondered whether the fact that these creatures concentrate this otherwise rather inconvenient to get at element might be used to help them get vanadium so they can make steels for soldiers' helmets and shells and what have you. And so they inquired at the Marine Biology Station at Monterey, and just pulled aside one of their scientists and asked him whether it would be possible. And nothing much more was ever heard about this, and but it seems they never took up the option.
Yeah, well, our government dollars at work, Hugh. We've been talking to Hugh Aldersley-Williams, author of the book Periodic Tales, A Cultural History of the Elements from Arsenic to Zinc. Hugh, if people like what they hear, they want to learn more about you, they want to learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, I have a website, which is hughaldersleywilliams.com. You have to spell my name right, but you can find it easily enough. And the book's published by Penguin, so they have it on their website, too.
Ah, that is wonderful. Hugh, thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay, great.